Though east is east, and west is west, and never the twain shall meet, till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat. Those words of Rudyard Kipling apply today, because even now making comparisons between America and the subcontinent of India is futile. It is a land of contrasts. Even the music will show that. Like the music, the country is organized and improvised, slow and fast, sad and happy, hectic and peaceful. And if music could show it, India is also wet and dry, clean and dirty, beautiful and shocking, rich and poor, colorful and drab. This is Monday at 1, a public affairs program of WJMA Radio Orange. I'm Phil Odebert, and welcome. During the next hour, I want to take you on a trip, 9,000 miles away. In fact, it is almost exactly halfway around the world. I want to take you on an audio tour of the dry western state of India known as Rajasthan. And you won't have to leave your armchair. I hope my tape recorder will help you see what I saw. How did I get there? Well, it's a long story, but briefly, I had the luck to be a member of a group study exchange team organized by the International Organization of the Rotary Club. The Orange Rotary Club sponsored me. The idea is to pair off sister Rotary districts around the world, and the districts conduct a cultural exchange. Rotary District 760 in Virginia makes up just about all of the Rotary Clubs east of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Rotary District 305 in India is mostly in Rajasthan, a huge area of territory stretching from the edge of New Delhi westward to the Pakistani border. A 5-man team of Indians came to Virginia last year and spent several weeks. Now it was our turn to send a team. 5 of us, all non-Rotarians, under the leadership of a 6th who was a Rotarian, took off from JFK Airport for the other side of the world this past January. During the entire stay in India, each of us stayed with Indian families. We moved around a lot. Sometimes we stayed with a different family each night. It was the experience of a lifetime, and I'll be back to tell you about it in a moment.
The next time someone comes to see you, give them a chance to see Virginia, too. After all, there are sights around every corner that people come from around the world to see. Places famous in history, like elegant presidential homes, picturesque towns from centuries past, romantic old plantations, and dramatic battlefields. There are the legendary Blue Ridge Mountains with their breathtaking scenery and glittering caverns. There are wide, warm, wonderful beaches, thrilling theme parks, places to visit just for the fun of it. Isn't it exciting that the best place to visit in all America also happens to be the place you live? Virginia. This year, share it with someone you love.
Oddly enough, one of the first things you notice about India is the traffic. First of all, there's lots of it, because we're talking about a country of 650 million people. Second of all, it's disorganized, with people going in all directions with very little regard to traffic laws. Roads are substandard. A major link between two cities of a million population each will often be one lane wide, which results in some interesting tests on your nerves when you meet a tractor-trailer coming from the opposite direction. On the city streets, the traffic is incredibly varied. Pedestrians, horse carts, push carts, cars, buses, motor scooters, bicycles, even elephants and camels all wind their way around each other in a cacophonous, exuberant, chaotic ballet set to the tune of whistles, horns, beeps, racing motors, bells, and shouts. All of these people are going somewhere, shopping, going to work, taking care of business. A typical city street is crammed with small stores, each selling something different. From used airplane tires, that's for the camel carts, to dried dung, that's for fueling cook stoves. The quality of merchandise, though, is generally excellent, and that's because it is usually handmade. Things are handmade in India not so much because there is a lack of machinery, but because there is a wealth of available, cheap, hard-working labor. The construction industry, for example, uses practically no machines. A foundation for a multi-story high-rise will be dug by hand. Each scrap of dirt was being carried out on baskets on women's heads. A bulldozer could do the whole job in a week, but its capital and operating costs would make it much more expensive than an army of laborers, each making about a dollar a day. Industry employs a huge amount of people, sometimes housing them as well. The average industry would be a nightmare to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And management people told us they often supplied their workers with goggles, safety shoes, and helmets. But the workers refused to wear them, preferring turbans and bare feet instead. A pesky problem in Rajasthan, India, is power outages every day, sometimes lasting 8 hours at a stretch. We were told that power had to be diverted to irrigate farmers' fields, or that a nuclear station was down. But what it really boiled down to was a bad case of short-sightedness on the part of the government. One plant manager said his energy costs had quintupled as a result. He has to operate on a fraction of capacity with diesel generators. He told me that governmental policy was tying the hands of industry in India. They can't import parts, they're taxed to death, there are no incentives, and to top it off, they promise electricity but cannot deliver. Manufacturing isn't quite so bad. Again, when in doubt on energy, use human power. One textile mill I saw ran just about everything by hand, right on down to the huge rolling and dyeing and stretching machines that were treating fabric. The end product, which are the saris that are a mainstay of any Indian woman's wardrobe, were folded, packaged, and stacked, all by an army of women and child laborers. The Indians have a saying, guest is God. Hospitality is a matter of national pride. Anything a guest wants, within reason, the host will supply. They are wonderful, warm, smiling people who have a certain sereneness and purity of spirit that's hard to find. They have a tremendous sense of civic duty, to the point that material comforts are not as important to them. The way the five team members learned about them was when we were staying in the host families. Here we could go one-on-one with the people. We could talk to their wives and children and experience their way of life. The homes we stayed in were of professional people, well off by Indian standards. The homes that we stayed in were usually high-ceilinged, made of cement or stone with stone floors and no heat. Temperatures in summer in Rajasthan regularly hit 115 degrees, and it rarely gets colder than about 50. So a cool house is a necessity. The houses were open. Sometimes birds would nest in the cranny in the living room, chirp around while we were eating dinner. Lighting consists of neon, so it's not too attractive at nighttime. The electrical wiring in the houses would not pass a Virginia State Building Inspection. A typical kitchen may have a sink, a two-burner gas stove, and that's it, sometimes a refrigerator. Furnishings are sparse but adequate. Wall decorations are either lavish or non-existent. The beds are hard but comfortable. The food is hot. We ate meat maybe 5 times during the whole trip, and 3 of those 5 times was in a Western-style hotel. The 5-star hotels, by the way, are the most luxurious and the cheapest in the world. A typical meal would consist of rice surrounded by various vegetables done in a hot curry sauce. Also, you'd have yogurt and various breads. Desserts were sweet, but that helped when your mouth was on fire from what you'd eaten before, because water and tea was rarely served until after the meal. Throughout our trip, our hosts kept forcing food on us to the point that it became a minor diplomatic problem to refuse. One day we counted it up and we ate 8 meals or small snacks in 1 16-hour period. The constant pushing of food on us may be an unconscious way of showing us and themselves that India's reputation as a land of hunger is unfounded. And in fact, we never really saw a case of malnutrition while we were there. Bear in mind, the state of Rajasthan is a rich one, and conditions to the east, in Calcutta, for example, may be vastly different. One of the greatest enjoyments of the trip was meeting kids. In India, in the upper middle classes, children enjoy a special status, one that says childhood is to be enjoyed. There's a tremendous atmosphere of love in the household. Children will sleep in the same bed with their parents up until school age.
Brown girl, brown girl.
Start! Start!
Brown girl in the rain. Tra-la-la-la. There's a brown girl in the rain. Tra-la-la-la-la. Brown girl in the rain. Tra-la-la-la. She looks like a sugar in a plum, plum, plum.
And for the upper middle classes, school is often private, but very inexpensive. They go to English-style institutions where they learn English as well as their national language, Hindi. When they grow up, their parents start thinking in terms of marriage. The way it's done is that the parents make all the arrangements. The eminently qualified sociologist, Dr. Prumila Kapoor, told us that love marriages are rare.
The boys, people come and see the girl, and then the boy will come with the parents or a little later. And then if the whole entire family approves of the girl, then, and the girl side, parents and all that feel that the boy is okay, then only formal consent is taken from the girl. She's asked, is it okay? And in 99% of the cases, she says, because she hasn't got her own say or her own, decision-making power to choose whether to marry or not to marry, when to marry, with whom to marry.
The odd thing is that these marriages are, for the most part, extremely stable. The divorce rate is so low in India, it cannot be measured. Perhaps one of the reasons for this is the role of women in Indian society.
In the traditional family of in India, the women's role is still confined to home. She's not sort of expected to go out of her house to do any work. Though working for women as such is not a new thing in our country, but in a different context. For example, in rural areas, women have always been working in the fields by the side of men, or say at craft with men. But along with that, it's only a sort of an extension of her home situation, because her house is there, home is there. She goes with her husband to the fields, does her work, and carries her children along if possible, and there she can look after the child and can do the jobs, come back home, look after the children, cook food for the husband, and look after the cattle if they are there. And like that, I mean, it's a continuous work for her. Mm-hmm. She gets up very early in the morning until late at night, quite late at night, she is working. So as far as she is concerned, the situation is that she has always been working, and there's no choice. She never had any choice. She has to work in any case to subsist. She hardly grudges because she has probably two things. One is that she knows that's her lot. And second is that she has never known anything different. And thirdly, that she has not that sort of consciousness that she has also certain privileges of that sort, that she can also relax for a little while. Mm-hmm. In rural areas, her life is very, very hard because she has to go miles and miles and miles even to fetch water for drinking and for cooking. She has to go miles and miles and miles in many of the villages in India for collecting the fuel for cooking. So all these things at least can be looked into. I mean, it's not possible for her to sit at home and not work. That's absolutely unsure because of the situation. She has to work. But if, for example, if these facilities are provided to her, probably her life can be less hard and less strenuous and more healthy in many ways because she's overburdened with work. Our constitution gives equal rights to men and women. In theory, we are considered to be absolutely equal and there is nothing that a woman cannot do in theory. But when it comes to in practice and in day-to-day life, then she is always left behind.
So how did it happen this way? Dr. Kapoor went back in history to about 500 BC.
The situation of women was equal to man in every respect. She was an equal partner in religious ceremonies. She was given equal education. And the ceremony that take place, that thread ceremony, which we call Yajnopavit, was given equally, celebrated equally for a female child and male child. And she took part in public life. She took part in the discussions on philosophy and on religion and on took part in political life. And she got married, and her age of marriage, because she was given education as much as the male child was given, her age of marriage was also, say, 16, 17, when that basic education, primary education had completed, she had completed. And she was given education in religion so that later on she could take part and participate in all the religious ceremonies and rituals and rites of the family. And because she got married at a mature age, according to that, in that context, it was a mature age of 16 or 17 years of girl, she had a say in the choice of a mate. But it was when the foreign invasion started, not one, but you know, India has been invaded since a long, long time. When these foreign invasions started, the security of the whole family, as a matter of fact, and women in the family, became a great problem. That how to secure the women of the family from the invaders. But when all these invasions and the situation, political, economic, and social situation started changing, then because a woman might not be, her chastity might not be spoiled or sullied by the invaders, they stopped sending girls to schools for education or to the education institutions. And they started protecting her by way of not giving her freedom of movement, which she had previously. And by trying to get her married at a very early age, so that their responsibility of protecting her and her chastity is no more there. And that she goes, gets married, and becomes wife of a particular man who will protect her later on. And that she will not be sullied, or her chastity will not be spoiled, and she will be a virgin at the time of marriage. And like this, the age at marriage came very, very low. They started marrying her at the girl, female children at the age of 5, 6, 7, even earlier than that, child marriages. And when she started having being given no education, her age at marriage came down, and she was married when she was absolutely immature in every respect, mentally, intellectually. Then even at her in-law's place, she was so small, I mean, as a child, that she had hardly any identity or say in anything. And she had hardly any say, and she never felt that there was anything, because in this situation they started preaching at home that your duty is that you are entirely dependent. That gradually brought the situation to a point where this very system of dowry, which is now existent and now making the life of even the educated earning women miserable, is dependent on the inferior status of women, which started right from the time when the education of women was stopped and everyone was competing that the youngest age we must get the girls married to the best family possible, and when there were only few families whose boys were well settled, in the way that this custom of dowry started, as a matter of fact, in the royal families of Rajputana, this Rajasthan of today.
So, in order to protect the wives and daughters from rape and abduction, the ancient civilizations kept them virtual prisoner in the household and married them off early. Because women were then forced into this subordinate position, the tradition of dowry came into being. A woman's family might pay up to $50,000 over the years to the family of the groom. Obviously, daughters are an economic liability and sons are an economic asset to a family, and a woman is considered to have failed until she produces a son. After the children are married, the parents can look forward to a secure life as senior citizens. The Indian family unit is a strong sociological organization. Parents, grandparents, children, uncles, aunts, nephews, and even visiting relatives all live in the same house, with the grandparents commanding the most respect. Nursing homes don't have much business in India. The idea is, we took care of you while you were growing up, now you will take care of us. Often the grandparents, parents, and children will sleep together in the same room, not because the house is too small, but because that's the way they like it. Families stick together. There's very little of this pushing them out of the nest at an early age syndrome. And privacy is hard to come by. Often a whole family would barge into my room while I was dressing to stare, ask questions, and talk. No knock on the door, just walked right on in. But privacy is not the way of the Indian people. A country with 650 million people offers precious little loneliness. The population problem in India is so scary, it's one of those things you don't even want to think about. But an ophthalmologist, Dr. R.M. Sahai, talks about it because his wife is actively involved as a gynecologist. He explains the problem.
Our population today is more than 600 million people. This is more than the total population of United States of America, Russia, and Japan put together. Every seventh man is an Indian. As regards the birth rate, we have 21 million births every year. 8 million dies every year. We add 13 million every year to our population, which is the total population of Australia. In other words, we add one Australia every year. This world will only hold 10 billion and no more in a proper way. In 1830, the world population was 1 billion. In 1930, the population increased to 2 billion in 100 years. In 1960, it became 3 billion. In 1975, it became 3.9 billion. Now we expect to reach 10 billion by the turn of the century in our own times, until unless drastic measures are taken all over the world, especially in countries, developing countries like India and other Asian countries,
Mexico
and other countries. Poverty is one of the important factors. population more with those who are underprivileged, underdeveloped. Easiest recreation and more growth. So, Government of India has taken this gigantic program of population control. At one stage, this program failed because the opposition parties used this as a tool to defeat this good cause, because they used this as a forced sterilization program which never existed, except maybe one or two sporadic cases somewhere. Democracy, as you know, is the main thing in India. The change of leadership took place, and here today we are working in a very, very democratic way. Understand what is family control or family planning program. It insists that you must have a family. Now, it's not a mere cut down the population without bothering to have a proper family. So one, you get married. Two, you have the first child at the earliest. Three, you should have one or two child. Four, you should not have a child after the age of 35. So by the age of you are 55, your child is grown enough to look after himself or support himself. This is a family welfare program. It's the illiteracy and the poverty put together. One, they don't understand everything, and they don't have the money even to buy the education for their children or they themselves at an earlier age. So once the poverty is there, the only means of recreation left to them is to indulge in sex. Even in villages where electricity is not there, they are using kerosene lamp. They don't want to use a lot of kerosene, so they go to bed early. Now the Government of India today is paying so much money, incentive money, 150, 120 rupees for each patient operated for this method. 15 rupees for each motivator. And the operation is done free on the top of it.
Dr. Sahai's wife has perfected a tubal ligation procedure. She can perform 50 sterilizations an hour on women. She lines them up, assembly line style, and gets to work, sometimes performing 400 sterilizations per day. She'll do this 3 weeks out of the month, 7 days a week. But she's just a drop in the bucket, playing a losing game. And of course, the only result is poverty. And poverty breeds poverty. We saw people in Delhi who live in the gutter. We saw flood victims where a whole family was living in something the size of a doghouse. Beggars are common. We were told that they refuse to work even if it's offered. We learned that some operate in gangs, with the gang leader keeping most of the proceeds brought in by the other beggars. We were told not to pay them because that only proves to them that begging is indeed a successful way of life. Some beggars fake disability, others are deformed on purpose because it makes them more effective. Probably the hardest thing to handle about the poverty is not the beggars, but the little kids. But you have to remember that the poverty problem has been emphasized by the Western media, and it's a media that doesn't realize that poverty is relative from one country to another. A family that can't afford a TV set in America might be considered poor. But in India, that's not so. In fact, one grandfather I met walked around barefoot every day with a 6-yard-long piece of homespun cloth wrapped around his waist, and those were his pants, and the same seam-split, moth-eaten jacket day in and day out, but he would produce thousands of dollars in jewels from the pockets of that jacket. Barefoot, a dhoti, which is what that little diaper is called, and an old jacket were comfortable to him. He had no reason to change. Personal possessions just weren't important on his list. On the other side, there is incredible wealth in India. The princes of bygone times built incredible palaces, with no regard to thrift. Palaces made of solid marble, screens on every window cut from single pieces of stone, rooms inlaid with jewels, and although the palaces are mostly museums now, there is a significant wealthy class, with some people owning whole villages. In fact, all the families I stayed with had servants, but of course, at $1 a day, or maybe $2 a day, servants are cheap. The most incredible example of wealth, though, is the Taj Mahal. It's built of marble, and it is considered to be the most perfectly proportioned building in the world. No photograph does it justice. It looks like it's projected onto the sky. It was built in the 17th century by a Muslim ruler who wanted to build a monument to his wife. After all, she produced many fine sons. When the building was finished, the ruler cut off the hands of his chief artisans so they couldn't build such a beautiful building again. Nowadays, guides take tourists inside the huge dome and chant Muslim prayers. The Muslim and Hindu religions share India. There are more Hindus than Muslims. Back in 1947, when the British undertook the painful job of splitting India into a Muslim nation, which is now Bangladesh and Pakistan, and India, which is primarily Hindu, the two religions were at each other's throats. Maybe 250,000 died that autumn as refugees from one area streamed to the other, meeting each other along the way. I cannot begin to explain the Hindu religion. Very few people really can. Suffice it to say that it is a way of life more than a religion. There are no preachers addressing congregations on Sundays. It is an intensely personal affair that each person adapts to himself in his quest for perfection. Some people forsake wife and family to travel on foot throughout the country without a stitch of clothes on, eating only what they can beg and what they can hold in two hands, sleeping only 15 minutes at a time in the forest. Others are more pragmatic about their religion. But there are things that don't make sense. There is a temple devoted to rats in India. Here the keepers make racket so that the thousands of rodents will scurry around the dark halls, eating their fill of grain offerings brought by the Indian people. And then there is the sacred cow. The idea is that the cow is a beast of burden. It is also a source of fuel from its dung. And it is the basic source of protein from its milk and related dairy products, such as ghee and yogurt. So killing it for meat would only eliminate the ongoing advantages that a live cow has to offer. Some cows are owned, others are strays, and all of them roam the streets at will. They have right of way on the streets and take advantage of that exalted position. Shopkeepers shoo them away from vegetable stalls, but no one lays a threatening hand on them, and the government sponsors rest homes for old cows too feeble to make it on the streets anymore. Does that sound like bagpipes? Well, you're right, they are. The British couldn't rule a country for some 400 years without leaving a mark of some kind. The result is Indians dressed in kilts, playing bagpipes, marching around a parade ground. The occasion was Republic Day, the 26th of January. It's India's Independence Day. And it was a perfect example of the melding of the Indian and British cultures. It was also a good example of the love the Indians have for ceremony. Robert's rules of order, formality, protocol, blazing extravaganzas are important to the Indians. So important that sometimes the real purpose of a meeting or a gathering is clouded by all the showiness. Another thing that the British left behind was the classic military band. But as you can see, the Indians have a different sense of music, and somehow they haven't really caught on to the timing and tuning necessary for a Western-style brass band to work. But neither have we caught on to the way the Indian band is to work. Let's listen to some examples. Most of what you've been hearing has been folk music, a fascinating music that alternates between rigid structure and pure improvisation. Those same two principles apply to the classical music, too. I met one fellow who's training to become a classical musician on the Hawaiian guitar. He had an old 1947 Gibson. He had reworked the bridge and nut so the string stood about an inch off the fingerboard. But when he played with the slide bar, he had had nothing to do with Hawaii. At another town, a little man who played the accordion and who was accompanied by a friend on the tabla drums got up on a high school stage and started to sing. That song is known as the Rajasthan Water Song. It's sort of a rain dance, and in Rajasthan, water is the key. They only get 12 inches a year, and it falls all in a 2-week period called the monsoon. The rest of the time, it is dry. But Rajasthan has the ability to not only feed itself, but a good portion of the rest of the India as well. That's because farmers use bullocks to turn wheels to lift water out of Persia. And oddly enough, the sediment in the canal water is deposited year after year onto the fields, thereby establishing a ground cover of rich, fertile soil over the desert sand. The climate is great, the growing season lasts the whole year, and as many as 4 crops will be rotated on the same field during that year. But mechanization on the farm is not advanced, and most of the work is done by hand. And a standard tractor in Rajasthan is not a tractor, but a camel. They cost about $250 apiece. There wasn't one day in India when I didn't see about a dozen of them. They're stronger than oxen. They can go a lot further without a tank of gas, up to a couple of weeks without water. We'll be back with more right after this.
I bought this gadget by mail. The ad said it would save me a lot of gas. It did. Since I put it in, my car won't start.
They said I could make money stuffing envelopes at home. I'd like to give those envelope guys a licking.
If you shop by mail and don't get what you were promised, it could be mail fraud, and there are many different kinds, from products that don't work to worthless work-at-home schemes. If you're a victim or even suspect mail fraud, call your postal inspector. It's his job to keep the mail a nice way to shop.
The ad said I could lose 20 pounds a week painlessly. What I lost was $20, and that hurt a lot.
They said there were hundreds of dollars to be made working at home. They were right. I worked at home, and they made hundreds of dollars.
Remember, most of the time when you shop by mail, you do get what you were promised. But if you suspect mail fraud, call your local post office and ask for your postal inspector or postmaster. Don't take getting taken. A public service announcement by this station and your postal service.
Welcome back to Mandit One, a visit to India. Our trip was cut short, and we had to come home early. That's because of the death of 55-year-old Henry Taylor of Richmond. He was our Rotarian leader on the trip. In the town of Ajmer, he took ill and died. I will be the first to say that India and unsanitary conditions in India had nothing to do with his death. Henry developed a knot in his heel as a result of phlebitis. The knot became affected of its own accord. It infected his bloodstream and killed him. On a Saturday evening, he was a healthy man. By 4 o'clock the next afternoon, he was dead. Falling ill in any foreign country is no joke, and dying 9,000 miles away from home makes it even more lonely and helpless. The doctors did everything they could, but the hospital, although well-intentioned, was a nightmare by American standards. The point of all this is that American standards do not apply in the rest of the world. There comes a point where making comparisons on anything is useless and futile, because it is so different that you are comparing apples to oranges. I guess that brings me back to Kipling. Oh, east is east, and west is west, and never the twain shall meet, till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat. That's our Mandit One for today, a visit to India. I'm Phil Odibear for Radio Orange News. I hope you can say you visited the country for a brief while yourself.